forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny, windy, quite cold for the morning hours, then partly sunny, windy, and cold for the afternoon, a high of 26, winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Right now, wind is from the west at 15. The temperature is 15 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. Wind chill is minus 9. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with the Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really happy to be sitting opposite James Schatzman, who has been on the morning show many, many times before, although I'm not sure he's ever been on the morning show exactly the way he's going to be on the program today, because Jim is going to be wearing two different hats today. In part one, we're going to be talking about his work as the founder and artistic director of the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, and we'll be talking specifically about their upcoming Lessons and Carols performance, which is this Saturday evening at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine. We also want to take some time talking with Jim about what he does during the day as director of the Racine Vocational Ministries Group, which works with a population that includes people coming out of prison or trying to exit gang life, homelessness, trying to make their way into what we think of as kind of mainstream society and into productive lives. And in many cases, that road is a bumpy one with all kinds of obstacles that we're not even aware of. And Racine Vocational Ministries does such good work to help ensure that that reentry is possible. And they have a special event that's going to be coming up on December 7th that we will be talking about as well. So there's a lot to cover. So Jim Schatzman, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Good to be here.
Glad we can have this conversation. You were telling me in terms of the Lessons and Carols of the Choral Arts Society that this is their 27th, and I just can't believe that. It just seems not quite like yesterday, but quite recently that you did that for the very first time. So first of all, maybe we should start with kind of an overarching conversation about what that even means, lessons and carols. For certain people that don't come from a certain tradition, they might not even really understand what that's all about.
It is clearly an English tradition, and this was started in England just after World War I, and so just fairly recently, a few years ago, celebrated its 100th anniversary of consecutive performances in England, and it's been kind of taken over by King's College. That has this is done every year. You can hear this on public radio in performance. It is essentially a service, and it is, as it says, you're going to experience it's actually technically called a festival of nine lessons and carols. Mm. And so you have nine readings from Scripture telling kind of the history of salvation, finishing at the birth narrative and with the reading from John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. In between each Scripture reading, there's a song that reflects on that particular reading. And so you have, we have 14 numbers that we're doing as preludes, postludes, choral benedictions, as well as reflections on each of the readings that, that happens. So there's a rhythm to this, mm-hmm. back and forth. Kind of you hear a song, you hear a reading, you hear a song, you hear a reading, and it's got a beautiful rhythm to it. Whoever designed this, I forget the reverend in England who designed this, but it's brilliant in its scope, and it has a real beautiful trajectory, and really an opportunity to go even though the readings are set multiple directions musically, you can do a lot of really creative things.
Right. It's a golden opportunity for a fine group to, in a sense, strut their stuff. Not that that's mm-hmm. what it's about, yeah. but that's sort of part of what the experience ends mm-hmm. up being for the mm-hmm. audience, to hear a good choral group doing a lot of different things, but all around a central theme. Mm-hmm. What are your memories of doing this for the first time 27 years ago?
Wow. I'm a bit of an Anglophile, and as you know, I spent 25 years conducting church music in the Anglican Church, and so this was part of kind of my ethos. Although I'd never done it, I remember listening one day at before Christmas and thinking, "Gosh, this would be fun. I should do this," and so we did. And first memories are, it's easy to romanticize them. It's been almost 30 years now, but it was a remarkable experience. And I think the chorus also responded in a terrific way. And now it's kind of a community tradition, and people have said to me over and over, this is how they start their Christmas season.
Mm-hmm. So you have done it in different places. I know in the Siena mm-hmm. Center, for one, mm-hmm. and I think maybe at least one other place, but this is at First Presbyterian, which, of course, mm-hmm. is a really lovely space to do a choral performance.
It is, and the acoustics are wonderful. The ambience is beautiful. Not even to say the way they care for their instruments. They have a wonderful piano and a glorious historic organ that's been there for a very long time. And so you have these beautiful instruments, this wonderful acoustic, and this fine choir. It's really quite a setting. But yes, we've done this. This is pretty portable. That's the one thing about this concert, as opposed to some of our others. It's just pretty easy to move from space to space. So we performed at St. Luke's for a number of years. We've done it at St. Joseph's Convent in Milwaukee, St. Mary's Church in Kenosha. There have been a number of spaces that we've been able to do this performance in. First Presbyterian has kind of become our home in the last, just pre-COVID, we started to kind of make our home there. Our office is there now. We've moved it from the City Hall into the First Presbyterian Church. We are doing some programs with them as well. We have another Christmas program coming up the week after at First Presbyterian on the 9th in the evening, called Candlelight Christmas. And we're going to be joining musicians from around Racine. I think you're involved in that. And so that'll be another lovely opportunity to present some music of the holidays in that wonderful space. So really what I was going to say about this, we're starting to build a relationship and a way of presenting the arts to Racine in that space as part of that congregation's mission.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with James Schatzman. He is in part one of today's morning show talking about the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin, of which he is the founder and artistic director. And we're talking very specifically about their performance coming up this Saturday evening, the first, what's the date?
December
2nd. December 2nd.
That's right, this Saturday.
December 2nd at First Presbyterian. That's what got me mixed up there for just a moment. And this is the 27th such performance of Lessons and Carols. And I'm just curious, what happened in 2020? Did you have to just skip it all together, or did you do something virtual?
We skipped the Lessons and Carols altogether, but we did do a presentation of we put together a Christmas story on a Russian tale and used some music that Choral Arts had done and packaged a virtual opportunity to meet with our audience.
Very good. Well, we are all in person, of course, now. And again, Saturday evening is when this year's Lessons and Carols will occur. So as you already touched on, there's just a wealth of amazing repertoire out there through history, of course. And I should think it's a really interesting and delicious challenge to each year decide what those carols will be. Just take us inside that process.
Well, it's really fun. I mean, there's so much new music being put out now, as we're more of a global community than a local community. And so you have, well, you have 100 years of English tradition that you can go back and look on. The English presentations themselves have brought in a lot of music other than just the English choral tradition. There's the whole American scene that you can take a look at and start to look around and dig around in. And, you know, every once in a while, somebody brings something remarkable to me and says, have you heard this piece? Mm. And, you know, and I'll think, well, I can see where that would fit after the fourth lesson in Lessons and Carols. Every year I get a chance to look in. And if you've gone to a lot of these concerts, you see there's kind of a core of things that we've built around over the last 20 years. So you'll hear things like, you know, In Soul Lord Jesus, Quickly Come of Paul Mons, which is an American masterpiece that's a pretty regular part of our performances. And you'll also hear things from the English tradition by Matthias and Sir David Wilcox and John Rutter and some of the greats who we know now, as well as some of the historical pieces we've done, the Beeple Ave Maria. We're not doing that this year, but that's one of those pieces that came across, a fascinating piece that was written by a German prisoner of war who actually was in Michigan at a prisoner camp and actually had a choir there. When he went back to Europe after the war, this was one of the pieces that put him on the map. And it's a stunning, stunning piece of music. So you can find pieces from everywhere. Folk songs. We're doing a new piece this year, a French carol, which is probably one of the oldest French carols that has been discovered. The English translation is Hear Me, Die Asen Ochsen, which Robert Shaw did and Alice Parker did an arrangement of years ago. So I've done that one and came across this wonderful arrangement for women this year. And so very excited to be presenting that piece. So it's always there's always something new and fun to see in this particular format. So for me, it never bores me.
Mm. So you've brought with you a compact disc that the Choral Arts put together way back in 2006. Mm-hmm. And this captures, I suppose, in essence, that Lessons and Carols and maybe fragments of a couple others from before. And two of the things that you're singing on Saturday night are on this disc.
Yes.
And we're going to listen to both of them. And we're going to start with the piece Sir Christmas. So this certainly requires a bit of an introduction, I should say, although it may be familiar to some people.
Yeah, this is really deeply part of that English tradition. Matthias was one of those very well-known British Isles composers who was very much in the circle of the cathedral choir tradition. He'd written a couple cantatas and some symphonies, but he's really known for his, in America, he's mostly known for his choral pieces. The thing about Matthias that's so wonderful is you never get any doubling of the organ in the choir, so it has a very thick sound, very rich, very diverse, very colorful. Although it's very distressing to the choir when they're sight reading it, once you get your arms around it, it's very exciting. The chords are big. The organ is big. He just has a really wonderful way of both dancing and presenting something with real power.
Cool. So here it is, the Choral Art Society from a few years back, singing Matthias's Sir Christmas. That is one exuberant piece of music, and I imagine, as you say, once you have it in hand, it's probably a great joy to sing.
It's really a lot of fun. The energy and the rhythm, the cross rhythms, the very thick chordal structure, extended chordal structure, the opportunity to shout at the end. It's just it just grows and grows. It's like, how can it get any bigger? And then you have that big shout at the end. It's a really remarkable, inventive piece that we really enjoy singing.
Yeah, I can well imagine. And I love the kind of the pungent dissonance of a lot of the harmonies. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot, of course, of what we hear at this time is very, very sweet to the point mm-hmm. sometimes of saccharine sweet. Mm-hmm. And this is joyful with the not the same kind of sweetness. Mm-hmm. And not that there's anything wrong with sweetness, but it's nice to, in a sense, experience other musical flavors. And that's
Absolutely.
Part of what this offers up then. Great. So Sir Christmas, this will be one of the pieces performed this Saturday evening by the Choral Arts Society at the First Presbyterian Church. And I know from this same disc, another piece that is going to be featured on the concert is one of the most beloved works by John Rutter. Tell us a little bit about him and about this particular piece.
The Shepherd's Pipe Carol is one of my favorite pieces, and I think one of a lot of people's favorite pieces. We were talking before the show how this kind of just burst on the scene as something very fresh, very, very new, and just sprightly. It's a dance. It's a story about a little boy who responds to the birth of the Christ child by playing his flute and taking part in the joy of the morning. And so you have a bit of a feature for the men, but it just dances. It's light. It's exactly the opposite of what we just listened to. it's a very light and sprightly kind of piece. It dances right along. Again, John Rutter is often harder than it seems. It comes off as sounding very natural and very organic, but a lot of work goes into getting all the words out in this piece. The pianist is under duress until they get this under their fingers, because it's a wild piece that is just wonderfully fun, but also very complicated.
Right,
just tough to get under your fingers. And Rutter, of course, now I remember an embarrassing moment. I was probably about my second year conducting at St. Luke's, and I ran into my high school band director, who directed choir over at Emmaus Lutheran. And he said to me, "Oh, you know John Rutter," and I'd never heard of him before. And this was in probably, I don't know, 78 or 79.
Oh.
Never heard of him. And he's like, "What? You conduct in the Anglican Church? You never heard of John Rutter?" So I had a very rude introduction from my wonderful high school band director, and I dove in. And this was one of the first pieces that we saw, along with his Gaelic Blessing that we did on another concert. Mm. That very first year that he mentioned it to me, I went straight to my files and started trying to find what I could find and buying records and trying to figure out who this person was. And now, certainly, it's like I've known him for, you know, it's been, you know, 30 years now that we've been experiencing John's music, both in a cultural sense and in a local sense at the Choral Arts Society. He's a world-class person who's still composing.
Right. And I appreciate, I mean, he's also one of those composers where after a while, he's easy to kind of shove to the side a little bit, because he has written so many things and got programmed so heavily. And then I know certain people kind mm-hmm. of decided at some point to just kind of step away and do other things. And I really think that does a disservice to just the wonderful craftsmanship of what he composes. And so I appreciate conductors like you who continue to appreciate John Rutter and continue to go back to him for various works that he has composed over the years. There's a lot to treasure in what he's done.
Absolutely.
So from this 2006 compact disc, we're going to listen to the Choral Arts Society perform the Shepherd's Pipe Carol of John Rutter. The Shepherd's Pipe Carol of John Rutter, and that will be on the program Saturday night by the Choral Arts Society, their 27th annual Lessons and Carols. So, Jim, for people who are interested in attending this single performance of the Lessons and Carols, what do they need to do?
Well, tickets will certainly be available at the door. You can also buy them at Julie's Personal Touch Flowers on the north side of Racine. They can also be purchased through our website at choralarts.org, choralartsonline.org. And we hope that you'll come. It's a wonderful space and a wonderful program, and it's sure to be a wonderful evening.
Right. And it might make sense to get your tickets ahead of time.
Yes.
Because it is, again, just this single performance. So, and a lot of people plan on attending, so don't leave it at the last second. But yes, and what's the starting time again?
Starting time is 7 p.m.
7 p.m. Saturday evening at First Presbyterian Church in downtown Racine, the Choral Arts doing their annual Lessons and Carols. And by the way, Jim, remind everybody about what follows after in terms of other performances by Choral Arts.
Well, it's a very big finish to our season this year. We will be doing a presentation of Carl Orff's Carmina Burana with the Studio of Classical Dance Arts. It's not as common to hear or see experience Carmina Burana as a ballet. And these young people are amazing dancers. The studio is a highly, highly skilled group. I remember the first time I saw them rehearse, I was just stunned, and then took part in their annual Nutcracker that's coming up pretty quick at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Don't have the date in my head, but if you want to see something spectacular or introduce your young children to ballet, this is a great opportunity to hear one of the classics in the literature done by some of the most gifted young people in our area. Give that commercial happily. We will be joining with them to do this iconic work in May, May 18th and 19th at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. It's just the most visually and orally stunning piece that I know of. It's if you are not sure what this piece is, you'll hear the introduction and go, oh yes, I've seen that in movies. I've heard that in commercials. It's just part of that movement in particular is almost part of our cultural heritage. And you hear it and you go, oh, that's Carmina Burana.
Right, exactly.
And it is a stunning work of beauty and diversity, and adding the ballet to it just gives it a visual impact that's just hard to believe.
Wow. So something to look forward to in the spring with the Choral Arts Society and their artistic director, Jim Schatzman. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. And for part two, we're going to continue to talk with Jim Schatzman, but now as director of Racine Vocational Ministries. And their annual recognition dinner is coming up on the 7th of December, in which Well, we're going to let Jim kind of share what happens on that really special evening. But ahead of that, for anybody listening who is not acquainted with Racine Vocational Ministries, I think it would be really important for us to make sure everybody understands your mission and the kind of role that you try to play in a whole lot of people's lives.
Racine Vocational Ministry is a program that is helping people to get not only back to work, but fully engaged in our community. We sometimes forget, or it's not on the front of our mind, that hundreds of people a year are coming back to the Racine-Kenosha area from prison. There are probably a couple of hundred people who are chronically homeless in the area, sometimes due to no fault of their own. We've worked with people whose companies just simply left town. And suddenly they've never applied for a job before. They have 20 years of career at a job, and they're not quite sure where to go from there or how to go there. Families end up sometimes unraveling. They're going hand to mouth, and losing a job or two in a family can be catastrophic. And suddenly they find themselves in a homeless shelter or even in their car, wondering how they're gonna make do moving forward. Or somebody coming back from prison who's been in prison for 5, 10, sometimes even 20 years, they come back and the community is completely different. Many of their family members have passed away since they've been gone. The house that they grew up in may have been razed. The city looks different. The harbor wasn't there. The whole harbor development wasn't there when they left. Their favorite restaurants are gone. Many of their friends, sadly enough, if you've been involved in gang activity or in kind of the criminal enterprise, many of the young men or young ladies you grew up with have passed away, sometimes tragically, and you weren't able to have any closure on that. It happens, and you're stuck away to deal with the fallout of it, but without the opportunity of having closure. And so when people come back into the community from situations like that, you find yourself isolated. You find yourself lost in terms of you lose a lot of your community connections. Think of all the people you know from the places you work. Those relationships have gone away. And it's very hard to get them started back up, especially if you violated community trust. There's a real resistance to letting you back into the system until you can build a trust or build new relationships to begin to be a part of that community again. We take civic engagement probably for granted, and the vast networks that we have of people that we know from church, that we know from work, that we know from friends of friends, the extended family. When you're in prison for 5 years, a lot of those relationships get severed, and sometimes your families are the last people you violated before you left. You may have stolen their television for your last fix before you were arrested and went to prison. And so how do you begin to make that? And if you become homeless, how do you take part in family events? A family potluck. You don't just go to the store and buy something and bring your casserole. And so often we find people will self-isolate once they're homeless. They're ashamed. They feel like they don't bring anything to the table. They don't want to be a burden. And so all those natural ties that we have that make our life just become fractured and sometimes completely severed. And so what RVM really does is tries to work with people to help them make those connections again. It's not just about getting a job. Matter of fact, it's probably less about getting a job than reconnecting civically, fully engaging to the community. It's just really important to help people kind of restore and give a sense of hope about how they move into their daily lives.
So how does somebody that finds themselves in this situation find Racine Vocational Ministries, or is it more that you find them? I mean, how does that very first connection even get made, particularly for somebody who does not have, in a sense, an engagement with the community already and has no idea that you exist or what you have to offer them?
Our marketing, although we're beginning to change some of that, we can talk about that later. Our marketing has been pretty substantially amongst our peer groups. And so the homeless shelters know who we are. The parole agents know who we are. Churches and pastors know who we are. And so when someone in a church, for example, loses a job, we've encouraged the pastors we know to say, we know church resources are limited. You know, churches can't support everybody in their congregation who loses their job. You can give a little help and you can give them a bump. Most pastors have a benevolence fund, but that runs out really quickly.
Yeah.
And pastors aren't social workers for the most part. They have congregations to run, and we forget how busy they are as people to run an organization like that with so many different tendrils. And so we encourage pastors to refer them to us, where we can schedule them for appointments and have and meet with them two or three times a week if necessary, especially once they get started. So we have referrals coming in. We're moving into our third decade of operations. Just finished our 20th year and now moving into our 21st year. So we're known on the street. People know us. We have helped over 5,000 people get back to jobs and work. We're approaching 5,200 people that we've helped in this specific area of getting back on their feet, reconnecting with their families. And so there's a network of people who have worked with us who are also in the community. And I've been in the business long enough now and have the gray hair to show for it that parents refer their children now. You know, their young persons maybe coming back from prison, or they're looking for their first job and they're not quite sure how to start. And so their parents go, well, I got help from these folks. Why don't you go on over there? And they'll call in. So we get some soft referrals from former participants. We get referrals from churches. We get referrals from the homeless shelter. We get referrals from the Department of Corrections. And that keeps us hopping.
Mm. So what is exactly the nature of the help that you are able to give somebody who comes through your door? First of all, you know, in that matter of getting a job, but all the other things that are also part of your mission.
It's really quite interesting because the people who come to us, very often the people who end up at RVM have failed in a lot of other areas. They've failed to negotiate the system of employment, and there might be mitigating factors. It might be a drug addiction. It might be a prison background, or it might be a background that's not very substantial in work, so their resume doesn't look very good. It might be a modest disability, which could be emotional, cognitive, or physical, and they're just having a tough time finding a job that matches their abilities to the market. It could be just that, like I said, it's a young person who just has never had a job before, and I'm surprised how many young people now don't have jobs as teenagers. When we were young, we got a job at McDonald's or bussing tables or whatever. But restaurants are now having a hard time finding people to do that. And so people move into their 20s and they have almost no work experience. And they've never interviewed. So so when they come to us, we're talking about a couple things. What are the barriers that are keeping you from looking employable to an employer? You know, is it the standard things? Is it how you dress? Is it how you communicate? Or is it the fact that you don't have a lot of work experience? Or is it the fact that you've had a difficult time managing an addiction? Or is it that you're caught in the midst of a domestic violence situation and you don't know how to move forward? We've had people who've gotten jobs and they're in the midst of a domestic situation and they have a black eye or a broken nose and they don't want to go into work. They're embarrassed. That's only their second or third week of the job, but they're embarrassed to engage with their employer, or they're being, terrified and they can't get to their employer. So it's helping people to untangle a myriad of different issues, which are almost none of them are about work. How do you keep your life together that can support a job? How can you build your network so that if your car breaks down, you've got three or four other options and you've got a plan for that so that your first week on the job and, in January and it's 20 below and your car doesn't start, who can you reach out to? That's not the time to think about it. And so what is your plan? If you talk to parents or aunts and uncles or best friends, you've got seven or eight options you can call. It's about keeping your cell phone on when you're broke and you have no money and you can't pay your cell phone bill. And so we may help with gas cards or phone cards or bus passes to help folks get around town and stay connected to the community around them, helping them to set up an email. It's some of our population is they're not computer literate, and they've never had an email account. And so if you can't keep your phone on, you got to have a way to get a hold of people. So we'll help them set up a Gmail account so they can put that on their resume, and an employer can get a hold of them if their phone runs out of minutes or they simply can't afford it anymore. So it's all these little things that help people stay connected so that they can begin their journey without bumps. And sometimes that takes several months to get an order before you're really ready to apply for a job. We never tell anybody you can't apply for a job, but we're pretty honest with people that you may not be in a position to do that now. You don't talk about your background very cleanly. You know, you need to let employer know why they should have you, not why they should not have you. And you have to rehearse that. We find that people who go and do interviews who have not really thought about what their barriers were and how they're overcoming them just stumble in an interview. And once an employer sees that, they can think, well, of the eight candidates I've got here, I'm going to take the one who's articulate enough to tell us why we should hire them. And they just end up on the outside over and over and over again. And so all these little things are critical. Or you interview extremely well, but you don't have steady transportation, or your phone can't stay on. You know, so the employer call. We've had people, the employer has tried to get a hold of them. They call us and they go, we can't get a hold of Fred. What's going on? Fred, you know, we get a hold of Fred and he says, well, my phone broke. You know, my auntie died. You know, my cousin was sick and I was doing all those things. They were more important. And so, you know, helping people to organize their lives in a way that can maintain a job is probably more important than getting a job in the case of most of the people that we work with.
Right. Well, and of course, we're in an environment now where there's a whole lot of employers who are, you know, desperate for good work, for good workers. And but you're right. If that other piece isn't part of this, you know, even if you hook up somebody with a job, with an employer, that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work until you've done kind of this work on the back end. So appreciate the meticulous way in which you really try to not do it all, but I mean you're trying to look at a bigger picture than just an unemployed person and a potential job. You're trying to, in a sense, your mission is to make it all work.
The quick fix is often a recipe for failure. Just giving somebody a vehicle, and there are organizations that just, they'll get people a vehicle, they'll make sure they're in a house, they'll set them up with enough supports to make that happen, and they're sending them off for a job right away, and the problems that caused them to be unemployed in the first place present very quickly in the job market again, and so they're just revolving in and out of entry-level jobs, which is not the way you build wealth. You know, if you keep starting, you know, $9 an hour jobs without benefits over and over and over again, even if you have those fairly continuously, you're not going to get ahead. Right. So it's the idea of how do we help people build careers and build the step ladder up to promotions.
So you have a special event that is coming up on December 7th, your annual recognition dinner. And this is an opportunity for you to celebrate some great successes and what and who have made those successes possible. Tell us something about this event and the sort of thought that goes into it.
Celebrate's really the right word. This event really centers on participants who throughout the year have done extraordinary things. And one of the themes of the event is ordinary people and extraordinary opportunities, extraordinary successes. We see people who have had almost no work experience, very low, unique job skills that translate into the opportunity to move beyond an entry-level job or just extraordinarily difficult life situations. And the work it takes to overcome them is so challenging. It's so hard to understand if you've never experienced it, to have this tsunami of things as barriers. It could be a single mom with children who didn't graduate from high school, has some criminal background, and is homeless. You know, you got to take those things one or two at a time, and really work at them to make them happen. And the people who tend to be most successful most quickly are very determined to handle three or four things at a time, and on all fronts, just keep chipping away at the things that you can do to build networks, to build skills. Single homeless mothers who are taking courses at Gateway Technical College and balancing all the things that they have to do with a very fractured network. So they can't just drop kids off at mom's house because relationship with mom is not so hot, or mom is not interested in helping out in that way. So how do you build the community infrastructure to begin to advance all those things forward? Well, as I said to you again before the show, when you do this work, it can be almost overwhelming. You see all the difficulties, and you begin to connect emotionally with the people you're working with and how tough it is. And when you really stop and look at the successes that people have had, it's a real joy to the staff to begin to see, oh, yeah, in the midst of the 40 people I'm working with, there's about 10 or more who have done some really extraordinary things. And so we start in about August to look at, you know, our caseloads and say, who's really making it happen here? So we start throwing names out, and you might have a list of about 30 to 40 people who have done some pretty extraordinary work. And we start staffing them. We start talking about them. We start, if, for example, if they're on supervision for as a parole agent, these things have to be approved by the agent. And so you start talking with the agent and others in their lives. How's it going? What's happening with this person? You talk to the person themselves and say, you know, how are things going? Tell me about what you've been able to accomplish. And you start to build a narrative around folks who have really done, and as you begin to really dig in, you start to appreciate the extraordinary effort it took to get from where they were to where they are now, sometimes only 6 to 7 to 8 months later, which feels like a lifetime to somebody who has no money, as somebody who's, you know, doesn't have any health care when they come in, and you're struggling to put those pieces together. And you start to see that they've got a vehicle now, and they're living in their very first apartment that they got themselves. You know, somebody else didn't give them the money for it. They earned it. They're starting to have capital, or, you know, sweat equity in their own lives, and you start to see this pride start to well up, and that their traction starts to create more energy to strive more, to not just take a course at Gateway, but to maybe to get an associate's degree in machine tool technology or cosmetology become a CNA and then think, wow, you know, I was able to do that. Maybe I want to be a nurse. And you see these career paths start to open up to people who came to you with no work history. It's just mountains of barriers. And you see the toughness and resilience that people have, and you start to connect to the toughness and resilience in particular individuals, not just as an abstract concept, but you start to see it in people. And then, you know, as the months go on, we continue to monitor and to make sure people are still going on a good track, and to support them in any way that we can. And then in December, we have this recognition event where, for very many of the people who are recognized, it's the first time they've ever gotten an award for anything. I had one person say, it's the first time I've been recognized for anything other than punching somebody in the face. You know, so it just was such a surprise, and it made me chuckle. But it says this is a new life. This is a new life. This is somebody who's now, you know, reaching out and helping people and paying it forward. And this particular person I'm mentioning, this was said to me in 2004, and now he owns his own business. You know, this is now, you know, almost 20 years later, and he's running his own trucking business.
Wow.
It's just amazing to see where he came from, you know, seven almost consecutive years of prison to now owning his own business, building a retirement. He got custody of his children, and two of them were honor roll students. It's just, you know, this is somebody who was raised in shocking depravity, a family that was, you know, wrapped up in criminality, and now he's going to prisons and jails and talking about how to make a successful reentry into the community, as well as raising two daughters, one of whom now is in college. He was the first person in his family to ever go to college, and now his daughters. You just see the change of trajectory of an entire family. You get one person helped, and sometimes, you know, what's the phrase? A rising tide raises all boats. Mm. And so, you know, he's talking to his nieces and nephews. He's talking to, you know, his daughters are role models now in their family for education. And his daughter's going to have a fine career at some point. She's a bright young lady. And so this is an opportunity for us to stop and recognize. And we have three tiers of awards. A Rising Star Award, which is for people who are just starting to get traction. They may not even have their first job yet, but they've gotten a couple classes at Gateway under their belt. They have started to repair their relationships with their children and their family members. They started to build a network, and they're really starting to get traction. Then we have what's called a Focus Award, which is the Focus Award people. 99% of them are working. Some of them are diving deeper into school. We have one awardee from years ago who came, a third-generation drug dealer, who ended up going to Gateway for a year, then ended up going to Parkside, graduated with honors, was head of the Black Student Union, went to Howard University and got two degrees, a master's degree and a PhD, and now he's teaching college. This is a third-generation drug dealer. And that's not everybody's trajectory, but it shows you that this community of poverty, of sometimes of criminality, it's like a diamond mine. If you work at it and you begin to really invest in this community, especially in individuals. If you invest in an individual, you can see them begin to get traction and to move into success. They just didn't think they had a shot at it. Mm-hmm. And once they begin to have hope that they have a shot at it, then their motivation starts to grow and magical things begin to happen. Mm-hmm. And so that we have a third award called a Beacon of Hope. And those are usually for folks who have been working for multiple years. They've really got their career going, not just a job, but they got their career going. And they're also beginning to give back to the community. Part of RVM's mission is to cultivate leaders in our community. So it's not just about maintenance. It's not just about, you know, just getting people a job and forgetting about them. We want our folks to begin to make a difference in their neighborhoods and in their families, and so that it spills over.